Welcome to this episode of Anaesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Dr. Samantha Black and I'm the Patient Information Lead here at the Royal College of Anaesthetists. Today I'm joined by Mary Carmen Clement from Sense About Science, a charity that promotes the public interest in sound science and evidence, and by Jane Hiddley, a member of the Royal College of Anaesthetists Patient Voices Group.
Hi.
Hello. Now, in the spirit of full disclosure, I should point out that the Royal College of Anaesthetists CEO, John O'Brien, is chair of the Board of Trustees at Sense About Science. We're recording this episode on the first day of the Royal College of Anaesthetists annual conference in Glasgow, right after the keynote talk on communicating risk to patients by Mary Carmen Clement and her collaborator, Lila Finnecarides, from the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication. Mary Carmen, hello, you've just come off the stage. How do you feel your talk went?
Hello. Well, I don't know how it went. What I can tell is that I really enjoyed it and I'm still like overexcited about it.
It was a fantastic talk. I think the whole audience felt really energized by talking about risk in such a brilliant way. So thank you. Jane, how have you found the conference so far?
Really enjoyed it. And I particularly really liked your talk. It was really inspirational, actually, because it really spoke to particularly the bit about risk being a feeling, because we do talk about risk in numbers and that's how you have to explain it to people. But the feeling side, I think, is very much forgotten when explaining that to patients.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That is one of the things that many times healthcare professionals forget to consider, that risk is also a feeling and it's not just about the numbers. Numbers are very important. We need to ensure that we explain them correctly, but we need to remember that risk is also a feeling. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the audience today have taken a lot from the talks given by both you and Lila. So thank you so much. Today for this podcast, we're going to be talking about risk, and how it's communicated to our patients in light of the Montgomery ruling. And GMC guidance states that doctors must try to find out what matters to patients so that they can share relevant information about the benefits and harms of proposed options and reasonable alternatives, including the option to take no action. The judgment also states that it cannot be left to the doctor to determine what is reasonable to disclose. The move is to what a patient would attach importance to. And I think we're all a bit guilty of bombarding patients with technical information which they can't reasonably be expected to grasp. And that's not the aim of risk communication. So I've got some questions for you. I think I'll start with Mary Carmen, if that's okay. So post-Montgomery and with the GMC guidance, what do you think the nuances of communicating risk are and how do we communicate them as clinicians?
Well, first of all, what you were saying was very relevant. Like, in general, we tend to assume that all people want the same things. Like, we assume that all patients want to have treatment when we know, no, not everyone wants to have a treatment. Also, we assume that everyone wants to live longer when, no, not everyone wants to live longer, or that is not the top priority. So in risk communication, it's absolutely relevant that, first of all, we remember that people are different, that they have different preferences and values. And that's why we should care so much about how we communicate risks so that they are actually useful for people to understand information and make the decisions they want to make for their bodies and lives. So there are many things that people should consider when communicating risks. And there are many short podcasts is not enough, but what if I emphasize four or five of them in a very concise way? One point is that we should not replace numbers with words. We know that communicating risks is a hard task to do. So many times we are tempted to say things like, oh, this risk is high or low or common or rare, when actually these words are ambiguous and they have different meanings to different people. So it's not that using words is prohibited. The point is that if you use them, you should add numbers to them because words have different meanings to different people. Another point is that when you communicate risks, I mean, understanding risks as a statistical value that is calculated in research is a probability that people need to understand. You need to consider the format of the numbers that you are using to help people understand them. Percentages are very popular, but people have serious issues to understand percentages when they are below one. Ideally, the best format to improve understanding and be able to make comparisons is using natural frequencies, keeping the denominator the same. For example, comparing 4 out of 100 versus 7 out of 100 instead of changing the denominator. Another point is that we should always add absolute risks and not only communicate relative risks alone. This is something that we see very often in the media. We see things like, general anesthesia increases the risk of, for example, dementia by 30% or reduces the risk of something else. And we see this in anesthesia and also about risk and benefits about foods, loads of medicines. But the point is that this type of communication with relative risks alone, it's not clear at all. If we say something like, oh, this doubles the risk of something else, double what? Triples what? 30% less of what? We need to answer that. And the way to answer that is by providing absolute risks. So this means providing the actual chances of experimenting an event in the groups that you are comparing. It could be the group having anesthesia versus not having it, or having one treatment versus a placebo, or whatever is that you are comparing. And talking about comparing, the next point is that we should be careful about comparators. This is something that apparently we love doing. We love providing making comparisons to convince people or to persuade them about which risks are relevant and which aren't, or which should be more concerning than other things. And as I was sharing in my talk, I told you that sharks are really, really compared to others, because we have this obsession to convince people that it's ridiculous to be scared about sharks, because the chances of actually dying from a shark attack is ridiculously small. And still, we know we are afraid of sharks. This is showing us that risk is very complex and is not only about the numbers, it's also a feeling. Using comparators is okay. Actually, comparators is an important tool to provide context to numbers, because we know numbers don't convey meaning by themselves. We need to add context so people can understand them. And one way to do this is by comparators. But we need to be careful by choosing the right comparators and to ensure that people find them useful to actually understand information and make decisions. So comparing the chances of dying from a shark attack versus dying from a fall or from flu, it's probably not going to be useful to be less scared about sharks. And the same happens with anesthesia. Telling people that it's more likely to die from a lightning strike than from anesthesia, that is not going to remove how the person feels about going through surgery and general anesthesia. And we need to understand that. So it's important that when we use comparators, we need to be careful about choosing the right ones. And one way to ensure we're choosing the right ones is by testing them. Ask people, how do you feel about these comparators, and find ones that actually make sense.
Oh, thank you, Mary Carmen. That was a brilliant explanation. Just moving over to Jane then. So on hearing what Mary Carmen has explained about how we should be communicating risks, have you yourself any experience in good risk communication and then potentially bad risk communication?
What I would say is, I can speak about it objectively, and I can speak about this objectively. I think from the clinician's point of view, it's incredibly important to assess the patient's individual level of risk. So some people don't want to know anything at all. And you've got to remember, we're talking about anesthesia here. And the primary reason why somebody is having an anesthetic is because they're actually thinking about the operation. So the reason you don't just have an anaesthetic, you're having an anaesthetic because you're having a primary operation. So, you know, the surgeon has said to you, they're talking to you about your operation first and foremost. So you've got that at the front of your mind as to whether you're going to, well, not survive. Well, hopefully you're going to survive that, but that comes with a level of risk as well. And then you're having to cope with somebody talking to you about the risk of having an anaesthetic. And often, and I think that Lila put this very well, is that people say, well, you are suddenly heaping another level of risk on top of me, and I need to know about that risk because I need to process it along with the fact that I'm having another procedure, which is actually the primary reason why I'm having an anaesthetic in the first place. So anecdotally, I can talk about people, for example, have had to have cancer operations, and then they've been told, well, you may not be able to have your cancer operation because you won't survive the anaesthetic. And that, you know, in some ways, that is sort of somebody saying to me, well, you know, people have said to me in the past, that sounds nuts because actually I need the cancer operation. I need the tumor removed. And I'm being told because of my heart, I may not survive having an anaesthetic. I could survive the cancer treatment and the cancer operations. I can see that the consultant here is telling me I need that, but I'm being stopped from having the life-saving operation on a risk which should not be there, a risk I'm trying to process. I'm trying to process the cancer pathway, and I'm being told there's a side risk here of having an anaesthetic. So what I would say is the clinician, first of all, has to think about risk and people's appetite to risk. And I personally, I want to look at numbers, and that works for me. Percentages do work for me. I'm also fairly risk averse personally as a lawyer. I want to know everything about risk. And because my first thought is I don't trust. I'm always thinking, yeah, okay, there could be a clinical negligence suit here, which is maybe a little bit unkind given the number of procedures, operations and treatment that happens every day in the NHS. Mm-hmm. But I think trust is not high at the moment within the NHS, given, you know, particularly what's happened this week, is people will be thinking, I just don't feel very comfortable at the moment. Unless I see facts on the table and I know people are actually acting in my best interests. So you can give me all the risks and I hear them and I see them, but I want to know if I am that one person in however many 100,000, that's me. And that doesn't help me that you've explained it to me. I want to know that I am going to be supported and helped. And the fact that you've given me this leaflet does not negate the fact that I am that one person. So that's what I would say.
Thank you, Jane. So what I'm taking away from you, from your perspective, is that probably the anaesthetic risk discussion occurs too late.
Yeah.
Or far too late, and should occur closer to that time of that surgery decision being made. And also that there should be some more shared decision making, particularly finding out what the patient's preferences are. Are they, because risk could be, one risk could be acceptable to one patient, but not acceptable to another. So I think that's a really important thing to find out in that discussion.
Because you've also got to understand that when people are processing, as I say, the primary operation, and they're having those conversations with their family about aftercare, about all those things, that is possibly at the front of their mind. Then they're talking about risk associated with another procedure, the anaesthetic. It's a lot to ask people to suddenly go, you're okay with that, aren't you? Here's all these facts and figures. You're fine with all of that, aren't you? And somebody's going to say, okay. I can't process this at the moment, but yeah, I've got all that. And they're probably likely to say, yes, okay, without really understanding.
Yeah, and there I would like to add something, and I'm going to use this chance to talk about the project that I am currently working on, this initiative called Risk Know-How. What we are doing is to try to improve the understanding of risk in multiple sectors. And one point about risks, as you were saying, is that people, obviously, in an ideal world, we would like to know our own chances. We would like to answer to that question, is that going to be me? What is going to happen to me? But that is impossible to answer because numbers, statistics, are calculated based on population data. They are not calculated based on individual data. We just don't have that information. And we need to be able to explain that. It might be disappointing from the patient's perspective because that is not the answer that you wanted, but the communication could be clearer. Now, the fact that risks refer to population data doesn't mean that we can make them more relevant for individuals. There are now initiatives to make risks more personalized, to put it that way. That means there are initiatives that are trying to calculate risks in ways that population is more similar to you, for example, the same age range or the same weight, same ethnicity, gender. But even in that situation, that risk is not about you, it's about people who are more similar to you. And one of the skills that we really need to improve on is about explaining uncertainties. Even when we calculate risks, they are never certain. It's not a guarantee. And one thing that healthcare professionals are not very good at yet, I know they are improving, but they are not very good at yet, is by explaining uncertainties around risks. And they should embrace more the uncertainty and learn strategies to explain this to patients.
Sorry, can I just come in there? Because I think it's a really good point about the data. Because unless you see the data and understand the data, it could well be that a certain ethnicity age of people report very late for an operation, let's say. And therefore, there's a higher morbidity in certain ethnicities for certain operations. And certain types of, they're more likely, if you like, to die under anaesthetic for certain types of operations. Now, it may well be that surgeons, let's say, or anaesthetists, yes, are more concerned about their facts and figures and do not want those statistics, if you like, against their name. And are more likely to say, we don't want to do those operations. Because of the facts and figures that will go against their name. So risk, presumably, it skews the data. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yep, that's a very valid point. And I think for us as clinicians in a very busy hospital, time pressures can really affect how we have those risk discussions. And I suppose we're all a bit guilty of rushing through or potentially persuading our patients in the language that we use when we portray risk to them. So if you guys can think of a magic trick to increase time for us, that would be wonderful. So at Mary Carmen, you've done quite a lot of work with the press and the media in portraying risk. How have you helped guide them in those discussions and what they then release to the press?
Well, the way I have helped them to improve this, first by making them aware about the lack of skills that they have to communicate risks, and showing them why this is so important. And what I do is that I teach them strategies to first interpret what risks mean and then be able to explain them. And one of the key things that I do with them is that I take them to the original sources of information, so scientific papers, and teach them where to find the risks reported in research, which are normally relative risks. And then I teach them how to transform that into absolute numbers and use clear sentences to explain them. And to do this, I also teach them about using tools that have been developed for this. For example, Real Risk is one of the tools that the Winton Center created, which guides people to identify the key numbers reported in the paper, and then everything that you need to take from the paper, and the tool gives you absolute numbers and graphs to explain the same result in a clear way. But one thing that I really want to emphasize, and I also talked about this during the talk, is that many times we blame the media and journalists about how unclearly they communicate risks, and also with a persuasive tendency. But this issue is not only about journalists. This is a generalized problem. And when you see press releases, many times they are not communicated clearly either. And also, when you go to papers, the original source of information, when you check the abstract, researchers, authors, many times are not reporting risks clearly by adding the absolute risks as well. So it's important to talk about the problems of bad reporting on risk of the media, but without ignoring that this is a chain of multiple steps where we need to improve risk communication, which begins in papers. Yeah.
Thank you. Jane, did you want to say anything about what you perceive in the papers when you read these headlines that appear?
I've got to say, I don't actually believe much that I see when there's reporting in papers, I've got to say, because it depends. Are you talking about medical journals, or are you talking about general
newspapers and health information portrayed within the media?
Exactly. I think it depends where the study comes from. I always look and see where the study comes from, because it will always be skewed to support who has funded that study, I've got to say. And national dailies, no. It depends whether they're, you know, politically, you know, where they lean to support their own point of view, definitely.
Yeah, and that point is very important. Like, it's talking about trust. What do people trust? And another thing that we need to improve in risk communication is becoming more trustworthy. Sometimes we ask the wrong question. We ask, how can I make people trust my media more, or to trust doctors more? That is the wrong question. We should ask, what can I do to deserve trust, so to become trustworthy? And that means clarifying your sources of information, providing balanced information, explaining uncertainties, all of that. And if that also includes being transparent about the funding. And for example, this is a point that also Tracy Brown from Sense About Science has emphasized, that it doesn't make always sense to reject research because of the funding it received, because projects need funding from somewhere. There are other questions that we can ask to check the quality of the evidence and how relevant it is.
Okay. So just for our listeners, if you could make one change today in how we communicate risk as anaesthetic clinicians, what would that be, Jane?
I would say, Sam, look at that patient sitting in front of you and treat them as an individual. Forget all your numbers and all the rest of it, and say, assess that individual's appetite for risk and treat them as an individual in front of you there.
Excellent, Jane. So very personalised risk discussion with that patient. And Mary Carmen?
I would say, remember, risk is not just a number, a percentage, or a probability. Risk is also a feeling. That means that people feel differently about different things. And what you need to do is to ensure that that feeling is not influenced by your poor communication of risks. So learn how to communicate risks properly.
Thank you so much to Mary Carmen Clement and Jane Hidley for this conversation on how we can better talk about risk with our patients. We'll provide links to further information and resources on this topic on the Royal College of Anaesthetists website and in the podcast description. And if you want more episodes like this, don't forget to subscribe to Anaesthesia on Air and review us whilst you're there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The RCOA warmly welcomes members from across the globe. So if you are based outside of the UK, we invite you to discover the array of benefits available to you as an RCOA international affiliate. To learn more about joining and to explore the benefits of membership, visit rcoa.ac.uk/international-affiliate or click on the link in the show notes.